If we look at management next, for hypothyroidism, usually treatment is based around thyroxine and you review doses 3 to 4 weekly initially. And just remember, in patients who are elderly or with cardiovascular disease, you may have to start with a lower prescribed dose. When it comes to hyperthyroidism, in terms of management, you would refer all these patients according to NICE-CKS. We can think of symptom control, for example, using beta blockers. And there are various methods for condition control as well. It starts with medication, two main drugs, carbimazole and propylthiouracil. We both of these think about bone marrow suppression. But some may go on to use radioiodine as well. And don't forget subclinical hypothyroidism. This is when you have a raised TSH but a normal T4 level. And if you get questions about further management of this condition, remember it depends on two things. Number one, your TSH level, and number two, whether there are any symptoms that can relate to potential hypothyroidism. So if your TSH level is 10 or above, then you'd be thinking about starting treatment, regardless of symptoms. Whereas if your TSH is less than 10, you can still consider a trial of treatment if someone has symptoms suggestive of hypothyroidism. Next, let's look at three conditions that can get quite confusing. Number one, Kohn syndrome. Number two, Addison's disease. And number three, Cushing syndrome. So let's start with Kohn syndrome. This is essentially high aldosterone levels. 3/4 of these are due to adrenal adenomas. So an adenoma on the adrenal gland that's pumping out too much aldosterone. And there's a key triad to remember. Hypertension, hypokalemia, and hypernatremia. High blood pressure, low potassium, high sodium. In terms of clinical presentation, questions might be quite vague, talking about things like lethargy and muscle weakness. And in terms of diagnosis, you're looking for a raised aldosterone-renin ratio or a raised urine aldosterone. If questions revolve around management, generally you're trying to treat the cause, for example, using surgery or spironolactone. You may have questions on the contraceptive option, in particular cosaprindiol or Dianet, which can be used at the severe stage. But the key thing to remember is that you should be stopping this medication 3 to 4 period cycles after the acne is improved, as it's not licensed for pure contraception use. And it's worth knowing a bit of detail about oral isotretinoin, also known as Roaccutane, which is only prescribed in secondary care. Remember, key contraindications are pregnancy and uncontrolled hyperlipidemia. We should be asking patients about contraception and also things like depression history as well. You may be asked about baseline tests, remember LFTs, lipids, and a pregnancy test. And you may get questions on side effects, and remember dryness of the skin and headaches are two that are worth remembering. And remember, if you see a question or an answer which says combine topical and oral antibiotics together, that's never going to be right. That should not happen in the management of acne as well. And in terms of the third type, neuropathic ulcers, these are caused by things like diabetes. They're always on the foot. They're generally on bony prominences. And there's often a history, for example, in a question of a minor injury. They're usually painless, deep, and they can be punched out in a similar way to arterial. The pulses are usually palpable, but the sensation may be reduced. And all these may be cues in a question that allow you to pick this up as an answer. It's worth reviewing tremors and gaits. Now, tremors are unintentional rhythmic movements of a body part. And there's three main types to remember. You have a rest tremor, which is worse at rest and eases with activity. Things like Parkinsonism tremors. You have a postural tremor, which is worse with a posture. For example, when you hold your arms out straight. Examples of cause are things like salbutamol use or hyperthyroidism. And then you have an intention tremor, which is worse on intention, i.e. worse on voluntary movements. For example, your finger-to-nose test, for example, makes it come on. Things like cerebellar causes like we talked about. So rest tremor 1, postural tremor 2, and intention tremor number 3. Management, of course, but other causes can lead to the symptoms as well. Vascular causes like stroke, certain medications, things like haloperidol, metoclopramide, prochlorperazine. Look for these in questions with these types of symptoms. And things like Alzheimer's disease as well. Refer all suspected Parkinson's urgently and untreated, according to NICE-CKS. And you may have questions about medications. Remember, levodopa plus or minus a dopa decarboxylase inhibitor, things like cocaridopa or cobenidopa, are usually going to be used first. But other options may pop up in questions, things like MAO-B inhibitors like selegiline, dopamine agonists, things like pramipexole, COMT inhibitors like entacapone, and things like amantadine as well. And it's worth being aware of some of these potentially secondary care medications. Remember we talked about the two-level well scoring for DVT? And we mentioned there's a separate two-level PE well score to think about as well. And the key score here is 5 or more. If your well's PE score is 5 or more, then it is more likely that you have a PE. Whereas with the DVT, remember, the key score is 2 or more. Now, if you have a likely PE, either a score of 5 or more, then you should be thinking of hospital for immediate CTPA investigation. If you think that the CTPA might be delayed, then you should be giving immediate low molecular weight heparin or fondaparin as treatment and arrange admission. If a PE is unlikely, i.e. a score of 0 to 4, then you carry out a D-dimer. And if a D-dimer is positive, then the options, as we've just mentioned, to either admit them for a CTPA or to start treatment and arrange admission later. And then you have your bacterial conjunctivitis. Again, these are usually self-limiting, again, within 5 to 10 days. The most common causes are strep pneumococcus, staph aureus, and Haemophilus influenza. We should be thinking about swabs if initial treatment fails, and first-line treatment, according to CKS, is chloramphenicol drops or ointment for 5 days, and second-line is fusidic acid drops for 7 days. It's worth remembering three classic pupils. Number one, Horner syndrome. Number two, Argyle-Robertson pupil. And number three, your Holmes Addy pupil. If you look at a Horner syndrome, it's a classic triad. Ptosis, meiosis, and anhidrosis. Droopy eyelid, small pupil, and lack of sweating on one side. Classically, we all think about tumours, in particular your Pancoast tumour in the apex of your lung. But don't forget, anything that affects the sympathetic nerve supply could potentially be a cause. And think about things in the neck, things like a large thyroid, things like a carotid aneurysm and enlarged lymph node, for example, as well as neurological conditions like MS. An Argyle-Robertson pupil is usually bilateral. I used to remember that as there's two L's in Argyle. They're irregular, small pupils, and you may remember it as the pupil that accommodates but doesn't react. If you get an Argyle-Robertson pupil, think about syphilis as one of the commonest causes as well. So moving on to end-stage renal failure, we're going to talk about dialysis first. Remember, there are two types of dialysis, hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. If you start with the hemodialysis, this is where you have blood passing through an external dialyzer and the substances pass in and out through an artificial membrane. Some of the problems include things like vascular access to try and get this blood out in the first place and things like cardiovascular effects as well. In terms of peritoneal dialysis, here you're using the patient's own peritoneum as the membrane instead of an artificial one. So you have a diacylate fluid that's passed into the abdominal cavity for filtration, and then it's removed again 6 to 8 hours later. Again, there are certain problems with this, things like leakage, peritonitis, and electrolyte imbalance. So two main types, hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. Now, if one of these is diagnosed using an OGD, they'll need H. pylori testing and then up to 8 weeks of PPI treatment. And then the next step depends on whether it's a gastric ulcer or a duodenal ulcer. The main difference is that if it's a gastric ulcer, you need to repeat the OGD to confirm that it's healed, whereas with a duodenal ulcer, you don't need to repeat the OGD. In both situations, however, you need to think about long-term acid suppression treatment. Generally, they're asymptomatic, and if they're asymptomatic and found on ultrasound, for example, then no treatment is usually needed. If they're symptomatic, then NICEKS advises referral due to potential complications. And potential complications, remember, you may have questions on any of these, maybe things like biliary colic, where you may get spasmodic or colicky pain, and you try and control this pain by reducing food triggers that may be apparent, or by things like analgesia. It may lead to obstructive jaundice. It may lead to cholecystitis, where you'd be thinking admission. And it may lead to cholangitis, which is infection of the common bile duct. And remember your classic triad of Charcot's triad, jaundice, fever, and right upper quadrant pain, you should think cholangitis. With gallstones, in terms of secondary care investigations, the patient may be having MRCPs or ERCPs. And ultimately, if it's symptomatic gallstones, then laparoscopic cholecystectomy is usually the endpoint. Next, let's focus on inflammatory bowel disease. And there are two types, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis as well. In terms of management of depression, you'd split it into mild, mild to moderate, and moderate to severe. In terms of mild depression, you'd think about an active monitoring approach, giving information, and then reviewing the patient again in 2 weeks. If it's considered mild to moderate depression, then you'd be thinking of a low-intensity psychological intervention, things like CBT, and you'd be avoiding the routine use of antidepressants. And if it's moderate to severe depression, you'd be thinking a combination of antidepressant and higher-intensity psychological intervention. So to help differentiate, you can move on to Veber's test. Now, in Veber's test, you place the tuning fork in the center of the forehead and you ask the patient where they hear it loudest. If the sound localizes to the normal side, it's likely to be a sensory neural deafness. Whereas if the sound localizes to the affected side, then it's likely to be a conductive deafness. For example, if the patient says, "Doctor, I can't hear on my left side," and you put the tuning fork in the center of the forehead, and the patient hears it on the normal side, i.e. the right side, then it's likely they've got a sensory neural deafness in that left ear. However, if they've got hearing loss on the left side and you place the tuning fork in the center of the head and they hear it loudest on the affected side, i.e. that left side, then it's telling you it's likely to be conductive deafness in the side that they can't hear very well. But now, the more common one to be used is the fever pain score. Here there are five characteristics to look out for. Number one, fever. Number two, purulence. Number three, attending within 3 days. Number four, inflamed tonsils. And number five, no cough. And a score of four or five signifies your high risk of bacterial infection. So moving on to the progesterone-only pill, or the mini pill. This is usually taken daily, so there's no break after 3 weeks. And there are tight time frames between which you should take the pill every day. Now, in terms of starting the progesterone-only pill, if you start it on day 1 to 5 of the cycle, you don't need any extra protection going forward. But if you start it on any other day of the cycle, then you need extra protection for 2 days, as opposed to 7 days, like the combined oral contraceptive pill. In terms of postpartum starting, there's no extra protection needed if you start it before day 21 postpartum. Next, we move on to autosomal recessive conditions. Examples are things like thalassemia, sickle cell disease, hemochromatosis, cystic fibrosis, Wilson's disease, and PKU, phenylketonuria. In autosomal recessive conditions, you need both genes to develop the condition, i.e. it's only expressed in its homozygous state. If you have one gene in an autosomal recessive condition, you become a carrier of the condition. There's no gender discrepancy again, but there's little variability of expression. Again, a couple of scenarios worth bearing in mind. Firstly, if one parent has the gene, there's a 0% chance the child will have the condition, there's a 50% chance the child will be a carrier, and there's a 50% chance the child will have nothing to do with the condition at all. Secondly, if two parents have the gene, there's a 25% chance the child will have the condition, there's a 50% chance the child will be a carrier, and a 25% chance that the child will have nothing to do with the condition at all. And again, it's worth drawing out those scenarios just so they're clear in your mind.